figure out how to turn it off, but I eventually did. So hopefully you'll all be able to come in and sit down and we'll get started. Before I introduce Levina, I just have to say that I feel so privileged to do it. She has been an inspiration to me and many other Mormon women, and I just want her to know how much I appreciate her. She gave me her little veto, and I'm going to tell you what it says, and then I'll add a couple of other things. just easy things, nice things, I promise. Levina Fielding Anderson is an editor of the Journal of Mormon History, a trustee of the Mormon Alliance, and the editor of its newsletter. She is writing a biography of Lucy Mack Smith and editing the autobiography of Hannah Tapfield, is that correct? King, Brigham Young's last plural wife. She is also married to Paul, and they are the parents of one son, Christian. They live in Salt Lake City. Marina, I'm going to get the last name wrong here. Marina Capella? Very good. Marina Capella is a graduate student of Stanford. She just graduated from Stanford with a Bachelor of Science in Biology. She is originally from Los Angeles, California. She is applying to medical school and working in a research lab right now. She's been married for 2 years and is Levina's daughter-in-law. And she also told me, as I was speaking with her, that she has just declared herself a feminist. So, yay. And we will now begin. And then Levina will go for half an hour. And we'll have 15 minutes for Marina. And then we'll have questions for 15 minutes after. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to say about Marina, I'm not quite sure how the invitation got the two of us hooked up on this part of the program, but I knew I would love whoever Christian chose to love and marry, but I did not expect that we would be such good friends, and it has been so wonderful to get to know Marina as a feminist, and I especially have appreciated her sharing with me all of the wonderful things that she has discovered on her own feminist journey at Stanford, including a class from Estelle Friedman, on which she got very good grades, I might add. But I knew we were going to get along great when she and Christian were engaged. The summer they were engaged, Marina was up here working. And for recreation, they used to take Fascinating Womanhood and do a dramatic reading of selected passages and then just laugh their heads off. So I knew that they were shaping up well. When Marjorie Pay Hinckley died on April 6th, 2004 at 92, an outpouring of feature articles and editorials in newspapers and magazines sincerely praised her, not only for her fine personal qualities, but also for the qualities that Mormonism currently values and subtly encourages for all of its women. About the third time, I read a statement attributed to her son, Clark, that she is the only person who can make President Hinckley back down. I began wondering why this trait seemed irresistible to reporters. Aside from the fact that in an increasingly authoritarian environment of the church, there's a subtle but real pleasure in knowing that the main Mormon, as one reporter called him, can meet his match in his own kitchen. But the question made me think about other presidential wives and their public image. As I ran back over those from my own lifetime, I realized that most played relatively minor ceremonial roles, were either ill themselves or married to men who, because of age and infirmity, did not have lengthy or vigorous presidencies. The main exception was Emma Ray Riggs McKay, wife of David O. McKay, who was church president during my youth and young adulthood. And at that point, I realized the marked difference in tone and public presentation between these two presidential couples. The McKays were models of eternal sweethearts and romance in marriage with the flavor of courtly passion. The Hinckleys, in contrast, present an image of much more pragmatic and egalitarian marriage. This paper first examines characteristics of both marriages, then analyzes the ways they are the same. I then argue that both marriages were based upon, accepted, and encouraged for church members a separate spheres model of gender relations. I am not criticizing either marriage as bad or inadequate, but I do want to look at some of the ways in which the separate spheres model privileges the male sphere and subordinates the female sphere, and thus prevents truly egalitarian marriages. And in case anybody is in doubt, I favor egalitarian marriage. The McKay marriage. A new compilation of President McKay's teachings includes many injunctions about courtship and marriage. He refers to his wife as my sweetheart and states, "A man succeeds and reaps the honor of public applause when in truth a beautiful, quiet woman has made it all possible, has by her tact and encouragement held him to his best, has had faith in him when his own faith languished, has cheered him with the unfailing assurance, you can, you must, you will." The first chapter in the memoirs of their oldest son is titled A Love Story. He states, "Their relationship was romantic. Mother always looked her best for father. She was petite and father was tall, but whenever she stood beside him, she unconsciously drew herself up to her full height. Even when they were both in their 80s and 90s, mother was conscious of her grooming. Whenever she was ill and confined to bed, she urged the nurse to hurry so that she could greet father with her hair combed, her lipstick on, and her bed jacket pretty and fresh. Until father was confined to a wheelchair, he always rose when she entered the room, always held her chair, always opened the car door for her, and always bade her goodbye and hello with an affectionate kiss. Mother always wanted to be with father and see to his every comfort. Because he disliked eating alone, mother would serve our meal and sit with us in pleasant conversation while we ate, but keep his dinner hot in the oven while he was at meetings, and then join him in a late supper. Mother made an extraordinarily delicious coconut custard pie. The custard itself was tinted pink, and the coconut, delicately toasted, made a beautiful topping. I recall that pie appearing for special occasions to father's invariable appreciation all the years I was growing up. Then, when my wife and I were having dinner with him at Laguna Beach in California many years later, Mildred, that's David Lawrence's wife, noticed coconut custard pie on the menu and called it to Mother's attention. We were astonished when she remarked simply, "I don't like coconut custard pie." I exclaimed, "You don't like it, but you've made it all these years." Mother smiled at me and said, "It was your father's favorite, and I made it, but I never ate it." And she ordered something else for dessert. Now, remember that story. We'll get back to it. In the Hinckley marriage, President Hinckley would certainly advocate the same courtesy in marriage and has made numerous public statements of tenderness and appreciation for Sister Hinckley. He typically refers to a man's wife, however, as his most important asset or possession. These metaphors shift the emphasis from the relationship-focused rapture of romance, which I'll admit is not always a good thing, to good management, conservativeness, and prudence, which are not always bad things. I certainly disclaim any insider knowledge of the Hinckley marriage, nor do I wish to imply any deficiencies in their relationship. Rather, I suggest that how they present themselves publicly and the difference in emphasis captured by the media reflect the rhetoric of society's increased valuing of more equal and less deferential partnerships. However, this relationship is not a partnership of equals. Rather, just like the McKays, husband and wife operate out of their individual strengths in overlapping but largely separate spheres to produce effective family and public life and to meet the needs of their children. Both of the Hinckleys have used metaphors suggesting equality. President Hinckley has repeatedly used the image of the husband and wife walking side by side and has insisted strongly that the husband is not superior to the wife. Quote, "Under the gospel plan, marriage is a companionship with equality between the partners. We walk side by side with respect, appreciation, and love for one another. There can be nothing of inferiority or superiority between the husband and the wife in the plan of the Lord." Now, you should know that this This paper is about 18 pages long, but I have 32 pages of footnotes, so if any of you want additional documentation on any of these points, I've got it. President Hinckley also takes the rhetorical pose, much to the enjoyment of his audiences, of the slightly henpecked husband. Speaking in a regional conference, he expressed serious appreciation for this dear little woman who has been my companion, my sweetheart, my love, the mother of my children, and then added, thank you, and the only one in the world who can tell me what to do when I do it, and have been doing it for a very, very long time. Sherry Dew reported the missionary meeting in London. Did I hear a cell phone? It's good that I didn't. Where President Hinckley announced, I'm going to exercise my prerogative and call on Sister Hinckley to talk with you. This is something for which I will pay a dear price, but so be it. He chuckled to himself as he turned from the podium. Without missing a beat, she stepped to the pulpit and said, I like this man a lot, but I like him sometimes a lot more than others. What would you do if you were married to a man like this? Everybody loved it. Sister Hinckley, for her part, presents herself equally to the delight of the audience as a spunky and independent adult. When a reporter asked her if it was difficult during her husband's long absences early in their marriage, she says matter-of-factly, no, I like to be in charge. She also added, then he'd come home and start running things. Sister Hinckley has repeated often, Gordon always let me do my own thing. He never insisted that I do anything his way, or any way for that matter. From the very beginning, he gave me space and let me fly. At a BYU's women's conference a few years ago, this is another example of her independent presentation of herself, one of the most popular sessions featured the three wives of the first presidency, each interviewed by a daughter, in Sister Hinckley's case by Virginia Lee Hinckley Pierce. Of course, these were not actual interviews, but rather carefully scripted performances, with the daughter paying tribute to the mother and feeding her questions that enabled her to tell an inspirational story or give a faith-affirming answer. This performance itself is a fruitful source of images about LDS good women. Sister Hinckley began her part of the panel by looking at the audience of thousands of women and commenting in mock astonishment, "My goodness, don't any of you have anything to do?" Then she proceeded to make transparent the structure of the performance, losing her place, asking Virginia sotto voce, are you supposed to read this or am I? And commenting with mock ruefulness when the smooth performance got tangled, uh-oh, we're really in trouble now. The camera on earlier audience pans had showed the women paying mild attention to the first two First Presidency wives, drinking water, flipping through books, rummaging in their purses, etc. When the camera scanned the crowd during Sister Hinckley's section, these same women were leaning forward, smiles on their faces, their demeanor transformed from polite interest to ardent attentiveness. About three-fourths of the way through the presentation, Sister Hinckley and Virginia, between them, had the cue cards in such disarray that Virginia, laughing helplessly, stared at the camera and declared, "This woman is out of control." Exactly, and the thousands of Mormon women in the Marriott Center loved it. Now, why was this image of Sister Hinckley so endearing? I hypothesize that although the script of all three women expressed gratitude for priesthood direction, faith in gospel principles, appreciation for temple marriage, and the privileges of motherhood, in other words, genuinely important and sincerely prized aspects of Mormon women's lives, Sister Hinckley managed to communicate these same principles, but without a subtext of subordination, submission, or deference to male authority. However, I want to suggest that this image of autonomy is more of an image than a reality, and that it flourishes only within the circumscribed boundaries of a Mormon woman's traditional sphere. Although I have emphasized the differences between the McKay and Hinckley marriages, what they have in common may be more important. In both cases, a man with a staggering public responsibility has been facilitated in his demanding church career by the deference, accommodation, and supportiveness of his wife. Both spouses assume that she will enable him, will not complain, and will be content and fulfilled in a secondary, not an equal role. Deference. On the first point, remember Clark Hinckley's comment that his mother was the only person who could make President Hinckley back down? The comment was originally published in this context. She has always been supportive of Dad, but she is also the only person who can make him back down. If she told him, "You are not going to tear up the kitchen this week, and that is final," he didn't touch the kitchen. And it's not just that he gives in. He stops blustering and starts to chuckle, then turns and walks out of the room with admiration written all over his face. I think he loves the feisty, independent part of her. It is significant to me that Marjorie Hinckley's renowned feistiness was exercised within the walls of her own home, where, thanks to the division of labor represented by the separate spheres' view of men's and women's roles, President Hinckley was actually trespassing in her domain. But in his domain, there is no question that Sister Hinckley plays a subordinate role. For example, when President Hinckley was planning a trip to the Orient, he mentioned that he might want her to accompany him, but did not tell her whether she would or not. The days passed, and finally, the night before he was due to depart, she asked, "Well, Gordon, am I going to go with you tomorrow or not?" He answered, "Do we have to decide that right now?" This story appears in his biography by Sherry Dew as an example of their mutual good humor and was also repeated at the funeral service. Perhaps some important contextual clues are missing, but I have difficulty interpreting this story as completely humorous. Sister Hinckley, interviewed by Sherry Dew, said, "When Gordon came home from his mission, I could tell that he had changed. I had always known he was remarkable, but now there was something even more distinctive about him. I knew that he loved me and that he would always be good to me, but I also knew that I would never come first with him." She paused for a moment before adding, "And that was okay." When I, Sherry Dew, suggested that some women might balk at such a situation, she replied, "I knew Gordon was going to devote his life to the Lord, and I couldn't think of anyone I'd rather have him devoted to." Here's an example of Sister McKay's subordination. In 1954, she was elected Utah's Mother of the Year. She had attempted to decline the nomination when it was first offered for three reasons. In the first place, I do not like publicity. Second, I am perfectly content to shine by the reflected light of my husband. And third, I would never receive the honor anyway because I do not deserve it. The fact that Sister McKay preserved all of President McKay's letters to her while he saved none of hers to him is also significant, I feel. On the second point, accommodation, the assumption seems to be in both marriages that the wife's time, interests, activities, and values will give way to the husband's at any point where there might be a conflict. The story of Sister Hinckley's having to ask the night before a projected trip that might last 2 or 3 weeks is an example. Sister McKay's parents were divorced, and perhaps this fact made Sister McKay particularly anxious to make her own marriage a success. When she and President McKay were engaged, her father sent her a letter of instructions. "Now, my darling daughter, a woman wants to study the likes and dislikes of her husband and try hard to do everything to accord with his likes. Some may say that it is not possible. I think it is right and possible. It will pay a wife to do it. Pay." All along the line, "When a true man sees his wife doing everything she can for his pleasure, will he not do likewise for his wife? Surely he will. Then there is mutual compensation and mutual happiness." His mention of pay and compensation are like the metaphors of assets and possessions. It clearly reveals the essentially economic basis of the marital relationship for the woman. Note its reappearance in this next quotation by Sister McKay. She was speaking to BYU women students when she had been married for 51 years. Among other things, she said, "A husband wants to see a wife who has made herself as beautiful as she can, a woman who has poise and charm, who greets him lovingly and cheerfully, who studies his every mood, and can tell when he wants to talk and when he would like a complete rest. Peace in the home is really a woman's responsibility, and if she wants happiness, she must work for it, yes, and pay for it, too, by being at all times kind, loving, self-sacrificing, ready to help, ready to serve, in fact, loving to do anything the head of the house desires, because his desires are also hers. And she must always remember that wisdom is made up of two parts, 9/10 silence and 1/10 brevity. There are many qualifications, there's more, that a woman should have to be a good wife and mother, but the most important is patience. Patience with children's and husbands' tempers. Patience with their misunderstandings, with their desires, with their actions. A sure way to bring gloom is to show that your feelings are hurt. You cannot live long with any human being and not have something come up at times to irritate you. Although we cannot help being hurt, what we can help is showing that we are hurt. Ruth Faust, wife of President James E. Faust, adds a vignette about Sister Hinckley's deference. During the time that President Hinckley and President Romney were ill, and President Hinckley was carrying such a difficult burden in the first presidency, Sister Hinckley asked me if she could have a ride to a particular function. She said, "I'm not going to drive anymore." When I asked her why, she said that she had returned home a little late recently, and President Hinckley had told her how relieved he was and how much he worried when she was out in the car. "Well," she said, "I don't want to add to your problems. You can cross that worry right off your list. I'll quit driving." Now, perhaps Sister Hinckley, who would have been no older than in her mid-70s at this point, genuinely felt that her driving skills had become inadequate. But I wonder if there were not some alternatives that would have limited her mobility less. The third quality, supportiveness, is the natural consequence of an accommodationist ideology. Although there were obviously ways in which the McKays and the Hinckleys were mutually supportive, both President McKay and President Hinckley used personal services, housekeeping, and pleasant uncomplainingness as markers of the kind of wifely supportiveness they valued. When President McKay was made a member of the First Presidency in 1934, he sent a letter to his children which referred only obliquely to his new calling, but instead focused on his sweet and charming wife. "Uncomplainingly, she has economized when our means have been limited, and that has been the case nearly all our lives. Always prompt with meals, she has never said an unpleasant word or even shown a frown when I have kept her waiting, sometimes for hours. If I had to take a train at midnight or after, she would either sit up with me or lie awake to make sure that I should not oversleep. If duty required me to leave at 5 o'clock in the morning, she was never satisfied unless she could prepare me a bite of breakfast before I left home. It has been Mother who remembered the birthdays and purchased the Christmas presents. She has never given me a single worry except when she was ill, and that has been, with few exceptions, only with the responsibilities of motherhood. Thus, my mind has been remarkably free to center upon the problems, cares, and requirements incident to my duties and responsibilities. Many an ache and pain she has endured in uncomplaining silence, so as not to give the least worry to the loved one to whom she was giving such tender care. Sometimes I have come home tired and irritable and have made remarks provocative of retaliating responses, but never to this day have you heard your mother say a cross or disrespectful word. Her education has enabled her to be a true helpmate, her congeniality and interest in my work a pleasing companion, her charm and unselfishness a lifelong sweetheart, her unbounded patience and intelligence insight into childhood a most devoted mother. These and many other virtues, combined with her loyalty and self-sacrificing devotion to her husband, compel me to crown her the sweetest, most helpful, most inspiring sweetheart and wife that ever inspired a man to noble endeavor." Similarly, Sister Hinckley took care of the housework and the children and never complained. The compilation of vignettes by and about Sister Hinckley included an undated letter from President Hinckley in response to the book addressed to "My darling," and continuing, "What a treasured companion you have been. Through all of these years we have walked side by side as equals before the Lord." The letter continues praising her speaking ability and then her personal services. "You have been my critic and my judge. You have seen to it that my shoes were shined, my tie straight, and my suit pressed. You have pushed aside the flattery that comes with public life and winnowed the kind and sincere words of honest and loving friends. You have held at bay that old fraud of adulation and kept my feet planted on the solid earth. How I appreciate you. Your voracious appetite for reading and your relentless pursuit of knowledge have kept you alert and refreshing throughout a long and fruitful life." President Hinckley also stressed that Sister Hinckley did not complain. "When our children were young, I would be gone for as long as 2 months at a time. There were not even telephone calls permitted in those days. We wrote letters. You never complained." Elder Bruce Hafen made the same point. She has said that she can't remember a time when our five children were growing up that their father was able to sit with us in church. Yet her children cannot remember ever once hearing their mother complain about the relentless demands the church made on their family. Sister Hinckley, in a speech to an unidentified audience of women, said, "Be cheerful. Don't be a whiner." She added in a clear definition of how she perceived her own role, I concluded long ago that my happiest role was that of a supporter. To me personally, this is a great and extremely satisfying role. As an example, she recounted how during World War II, President Hinckley planted 3,000 tomato plants, and then she spent her days picking them when they got ripe. Then they sold them. Then we couldn't give them away. But the tomatoes went on people's food shelves, and the money we were paid for them paid the taxes that year, the taxes on our home, the house that gave us shelter and was a home for our children. The whole project gave my husband and me a sense of togetherness. The wife does not walk in front of or behind her husband, but at his side, and what is a blessing for him is a blessing for her. I have never felt to apologize to anyone for my supporting role as a wife and mother. There is no question that this separate spheres model is the church's official model today, in spite of the side-by-side rhetoric. Part of this project was going to be an analysis of Mormon women's obituaries published in Salt Lake City newspapers for a month-long period following Sister Hinckley's funeral. I wanted to see how Mormon families praised their women publicly, even when they had to pay for the privilege by the word, but space precludes a discussion of the findings. I was struck, however, by one very lengthy obituary that praised the deceased in these terms. Shirley was first and foremost a wife and mother, and that is where her heart always was. Ever devoted, Shirley attended to her husband and family so Don could build a business, not specified, and serve the church. As Don always said, I made the living, but Shirley made the living worthwhile. Now, interestingly, most obituaries will list a couple of callings that the woman had or say she served in many different positions in the church. This one didn't mention what that was, even though they were clearly a Mormon couple. Instead, the obituary lists her culinary skills and personal attentions. Ever thoughtful, Shirley's attention to little things made life pleasant for her family. Ironing sheets and pillowcases, squeezing fresh orange juice, or bringing ice water to her four children in the middle of the night were never a burden to her. Her Sunday dinner, served as if royalty were attending, were made with care and love. She was renowned for her delicious hot breakfasts, which were particularly enjoyed by her 16 grandchildren. Her Christmas fruit and prime rib roast with mashed potatoes and gravy were exquisite. Ever present, Shirley would welcome her children when they came home from school, quite often with freshly baked cookies or chocolate donuts and milk. Nighttime prayers, a tuck into bed, a lullaby, and a kiss were all part of Shirley's nurturing, loving way. I am certainly not saying that this woman's choice was not a valid and valuable one, but I am saying that it reflects and continues the separate spheres model of gender roles. And even though a woman may have great independence and creativity within her sphere, that sphere is always subordinated to the male sphere. I think that model is not the most desirable one for growing the healthiest, happiest, most fully realized human beings. For one thing, because it confines women to domestic and parenting roles, it simultaneously frees men from those responsibilities while requiring them to praise their wives for their success in that sphere. Thus, we have the ironic spectacle of President Hinckley, on the one hand, placing parenthood at the absolute pinnacle of success. Quote, "Of all the joys of life, none other equals that of happy parenthood. Of all the responsibilities, none other is so serious. To rear children in an atmosphere of love, security, and faith is the most rewarding of all challenges. The good results from such efforts becomes life's most satisfying compensation." But on the other hand, he simultaneously says, "I'm grateful to say our families turned out amazingly well, and I give all of the credit to this little lady." He also tells us another of those humorous stories with an unexpected sting. "When our children call home, our grown sons," he doesn't mention the daughters, even though there are three daughters and two sons, "one is a stake president and the other a member of a high council. They never want to talk with me. If I answer the phone, they say, 'Is mother there?'" This kind of internal contradiction and exclusion from a full share of parenting is not a healthy situation for either women or men, and I suspect it's not all that great for children either. Second, both President and Sister Hinckley reinforce separate sphere ideology in their addresses with a rhetorical technique that deserves closer examination. For want of a better term, I call it the coercive compliment. meaning that the speaker apparently expresses appreciation to women for their good traits, but is really instructing them to acquire these traits. For example, President Hinckley has praised women. What a resource are the women of the church. You love this church. You accept its doctrine. You honor your place in its organization. You bring luster and strength and beauty to its congregations. You bring a measure of wholeness to us. Who is us in the sentence? And then there's a long quote from Sister Hinckley that says exactly the same thing. By my informal and anecdotal evaluations, the result of these coercive compliments is not a sense of being appreciated, but of intense guilt. No woman I have talked to has agreed that, in fact, she fits these models. They feel resentment and frustration that the speaker just doesn't get it. But most listeners also feel that they must try harder, and especially that they must conceal their deficiencies, since they don't want to be seen as violating the Mormon norm. And how, since this is what God intends them to do, can they carve out a different path for themselves? So one consequence of the separate sphere ideology is an emotional backlash. Another is the sheer waste at not drawing on all of the strengths of both men and women in developing their talents professionally, personally, and parentally. In this regard, the new Vatican statement demonizing feminism in its letter to bishops and President Faust's rather tortuous defense of traditional gender roles in the August Ensign would replay close scrutiny. A third consequence is the downstream social effects. Although conference addresses are loud and frequent in their warnings about the deterioration of the American family, there is little or no recognition of the effects of isolating women in the home and limiting them to exclusively domestic tasks. The same month of Sister Hinckley's death, local papers published a report showing that Utah was the fifth worst state in the nation in terms of women's remuneration. Women with full-time year-round jobs make 70.3 cents for each dollar earned by men, compared to 76.2% for women in the nation. 61% of Utah women work, compared with 57.5% nationwide. One columnist citing and commenting on these statistics, plus the fact that Utah has a higher divorce rate than the rest of the nation, noted, "Utah is a state that clings to traditional values. Perhaps more than anywhere else in the nation, women marry young with the intention of raising children on a single income earned by their husbands, and therefore do not prepare themselves with education and work experience that could assure them an adequate living wage." In conclusion, I salute the good qualities in both the McKay and the Hinckley marriages, but I think it's time we find a different model upon which to base our own.
Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure for me to be here today and to get to respond to Levina's excellent paper. Levina mentioned some things about me earlier, and I was just remembering while I was sitting there that when I met Christian 3 years ago, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. In fact, I'd never even heard about Sunstone, and I recall one time a few months into our courtship that we were at the Los Angeles Temple and walking around the visitor center, and there was a big, huge family proclamation on the wall, and Christian sort of hissed at it, and I saw that, and I just got so mad. I couldn't understand why and what was wrong with it. And I've changed a lot in 3 years, so. I begin with a chorus of amens regarding Levina's paper. After all, I didn't get to be her daughter-in-law for nothing. First of all, I agree with her central thesis that despite rhetoric of egalitarianism, the McKay and Hinckley marriages represented and encouraged a separate spheres model of gender relations. An increasing insistence that the traditional Mormon marriage and family life is one of equality seems to be little more than the newest marketing scheme, just a shiny new package containing and poorly disguising the same old product. In Levina's case studies of the McKay and Hinckley marriages, the product of separate sphere relations encouraged deference, accommodation, and supportiveness on the part of women, rather than genuine equality. You no doubt cringed, as I did, at the contents of some of the quotations cited. There is something disturbing to me in the idea that a woman ill enough to be confined to bed would worry about having her hair combed, lipstick on, and a bed jacket pretty and fresh before greeting her husband. Something that suggests a contortion of priorities as well as a problem of gender relations. I also agree with the implication that the separate spheres model is increasingly untenable in the modern day, and when church leaders try to discuss it in politically correct ways, they end up in logical knots. Hinckley's insistence on the primacy of child rearing, when he himself disavows a role in his children's upbringing, is just one example. Another is the eternal nature of gender roles. If gender were indeed eternal and innate, as the Proclamation on the Family clearly affirms, why do church leaders feel the need to define it at all, much less repeatedly? If a so-called nurturing manner were indeed an instinctive predisposition belonging to the female sex, why would increasing numbers of women opt out of the type of lifestyle that provides the greatest opportunity for use of such an attribute? If only one sexual identity is ever natural, why, as President Faust reminds us in this month's Ensign, does a father need to be present in the home for it to develop naturally? Why, too, do we worship a father in heaven and savior who epitomize nurturing, caregiving behavior, and charity, yet insist that these are spiritually female characteristics? As the elders' quorum president in my home ward quipped, "I'm starting to lose my masculine identity. I'd better stop being so nurturing." The discussion of coercive compliments was particularly illuminating. I know from experience that such a technique of instructive praise breeds guilt and other emotional backlash among Mormon women. A similar effect is achieved by the effusive praise heaped on wives of church authorities, local leaders, and even lay members, with the perhaps unintentional effect of creating a normative veneer of womanly perfection. One Asian woman in my ward admitted, "When I joined the church, I thought of Mormon families as happy parents with well-behaved, happy children. But when my family actually happened," and she went on to describe the process of disillusionment, I could never admit in Relief Society that I sometimes yell at my children, even though I know other women do the same. In addition to the shame produced, I add that this rhetorical practice abrogates the core principle of our religion, the need for a Savior's atoning sacrifice. If some women did indeed possess all the attributes ascribed to them, excuse me, these perfect ladies would ascend to the realms above on their own wings. However, I also feel that Mormon women, as auditors of this kind of information, could easily avoid feelings of culpability by simply refusing to idolize figures like prophets' wives. The belief that somewhere out there is a woman that never yells at her children, or like Sister McKay, never complains or utters a crossword, is the mortar that holds the facade together. If my friend believed that the Relief Society present occasionally lost her temper and yelled at her children, she might feel less inhibited about sharing her frustrations with fellow members of the Relief Society. A part company with Levina in her conclusion that the separate spheres model of gender relations, which she claims is not the most desirable for growing the healthiest, happiest, most fully realized human beings, should be superseded by a more egalitarian one. Though certainly not fulfilling for me, I believe that separate spheres does provide a meaningful and fulfilling life experience for many women in the church, my own mother, I believe, being one of them, and that this lifestyle should be an unstigmatized option for church couples. Yet I also believe that other equally unstigmatized alternatives should be developed and encouraged within the church. As we have recently been reminded in Utah, not all types of relationships are healthy or acceptable. Although every relationship is unique, I would like to propose four rudimentary criteria that I see as constant across healthy Mormon relationships, marriage relationships. The relationship encourages the development of godly attributes in both individuals over a permanent time span. Secondly, it is in accordance with scriptural teachings about interpersonal relationships that's contained in the standard works. Thirdly, the relationship must be perceived as just, though not necessarily equal by both individuals. Fourth, it must work. That is, it must provide mutual long-term satisfaction. According to the evidence cited, the Hinckley and McKay relationships fit these criteria. In each, both partners express satisfaction with the justice of their roles, believe that these roles are scriptural, and report the development of attributes such as patience, supportiveness, good humor, and a genuine altruistic concern for others. I believe that all of the characteristics mentioned are good per se. For example, giving into a spouse's preference, like Sister McKay's making of the coconut cake for years and years, can be a kind gesture of love and selflessness. However, I believe there is something fundamentally wrong with assigning these responsibilities to only one partner solely because of that partner's sex. This is one reason why, in my own marriage, my husband and I choose to reject the separate spheres model. In the spirit of accepting a diversity of models, I would like to describe the model we use instead, in hopes that some pieces of it may be useful as an alternative. All right, actually I found it. Since Christian and I are both biologists, we have attempted to read Genesis as a natural history. Humankind, or Adam in Hebrew, began to develop a moral sense, the knowledge of good and evil. With this increased ability came a recognition of the difference in capacities between most humans versus pregnant or postpartum women, thus the invention of two social categories, male, or ish, and female, isha. According to the Hebrew account, femaleness is taken out of humankind, not out of man. We are told that one of the results of this is increased cognitive power. We are told that one of the results of this increased cognitive power is that the special category of reproductively active women will experience increased pain in childbirth, perhaps due to the increased infant skull volume required by a morally reasoning cortex. Another is that humankind, Adam, not only males, must work. As a result, we believe the scriptures do encourage the labor of both men and women, except when biologically impossible. A type of labor that includes raising both bread and children by the sweat of the brow. Time precludes further elaboration, but in combination with an interpretation of the temple ceremony that allows Adam to symbolize Christ and his bride to symbolize the church, we believe that there is a scriptural model for non-gendered assignation of duties. We both see this model as fair and as an optimal way for us to progress spiritually. I hope nobody thinks I'm proposing our model as a new ideal, however. This would be replacing one coercive paradigm with another. Even if one model does end up being ideal for everyone now, I hope that as time, culture, and social systems change, people will continue to develop their own models in response to changing needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Levine and Marina. I'm supposed to remind you that if you would come up to ask your questions into the microphone so it could be on the tape. If you don't feel like you can, I can try and repeat them for you. But if you have questions, you can come on up now. And the stairs are over there. Sorry.
Levina, thank you for this wonderful rhetorical analysis. My question would be, do you see in Mormon discourse examples that subvert this model of assigned gender roles? Examples of perhaps pioneer women in the 19th century building cabins, doing things that men are supposed to do, or men staying home and baking cookies for the children?
But in official discourse, the power of the coercive model is really quite strong. I remember when I was working at the Ensign, one of the articles that we published in the early 1970s was Mother Killed the Rattlesnakes by Emma Lou Fain. And it took the explicit position that in her parents' marriage, they divided up the tasks according to who was best at doing it. And that meant that her father scrubbed the floor on his hands and knees because that was hard physical labor, and mother killed the rattlesnakes because she was the one up in the cabin, up at the cabin where the rattlesnakes were, and the children were, and knew how to do it. And there was quite a lot of fallout about that. It kept being referred to for years about how this model was not a good one because it gave women the wrong idea about the relationship. It was always cast as a problem for women, not for men, but for women. And I think that the models that we have of nurturing in President Faust's message this month, which Marina referred to, he says something like priesthood is not gender, we are supposed to follow the model of Christ as he loves and serves others as an example of, you know, and that part's fine. You think, oh well, what's new about that? And then he adds of fatherhood. So we're supposed to follow the example of Christ of fatherhood. And I immediately had a problem with that because except in the metaphoric sense that Christ is the father of the believer, we don't have examples of him as a father. And the other problem with it is that he talked about how honoring the priesthood will bring imperceptible but real effects in the home. And my problem with that is, if the effects really are imperceptible, then in what way are they real? So in almost every paragraph, President Faust tied himself in a knot trying to talk egalitarian talk but keep on walking the separate spheres walk. And I have, at least 5 or 6 pages of footnotes on the ways in which that separate spheres model is reinforced for young women and for women. And I think that if anything, we are further away from models of nurturing men and achieving women, if you want to use those two stereotypes. And I'm a little reluctant to do it because replacing one stereotype with another stereotype has problems. So, but are things getting worse more slowly? Possibly.
Yes,
Well, I think the question was, as the church tries to conform, as society moves more in the direction of egalitarian marriage, will the church follow, and will the younger generation growing up in an egalitarian society move the church? Unquestionably, indubitably. I think that you could all tell from Marina's response that she and Christian have negotiated a different model for themselves than the one they got handed on silver platters from both directions, I might add. But I also think that it's actually encouraging to read a First Presidency's message as confused and illogical as Elder Faust's, because it means that they know that the separate spheres ideology is not working, and so they're trying to sound more egalitarian. And I think as the level of confusion rises, that the system will collapse and that people will end up making other choices. But I do agree Marina made a point that I really agree with too, which is that we really need to have a system, not one that rewards one model and punishes all the rest, but validates many different styles of models.
As I understand what's being reported about Elder Faust's statement, there's a recognition of the failure of the standard interpretation of the standard model to encourage the development of compassion, nurturing, whatever, among men. Is that a correct interpretation?
No, I think that the rhetoric is good priesthood holders are nice people, they help others, they're involved fathers, they're nurturing husbands, they appreciate their wives and manage them like good assets.
That sounds more like coercive praise again for the men. But the point I wanted to make was, as much as I appreciate the value of multiple models, I think it is the case that some models encourage the development of certain character traits better than other models do. And I had breakfast or lunch very recently with a friend who talked about a marriage that was falling apart with a husband who was only complaining about everything that was done, and she kept saying, "You don't like it this way? Stop working. Let me work, and you come home and do it." And after a couple of years of that, and having made tons of money, they left the big city, they went, and they did that. And he became a completely different person. After scrubbing the floors, after getting the kids off to their softball games and their school and making their lunches and everything like that, after 2 years of this, he was an understanding, loving, kind, wonderful man, according to her. And things were really bad before that. And I like to think that we don't all need that, but that if, you know, we think one model is working for us, it might not be as well as others, and that the more egalitarian model might really produce better people.
That's an inspirational story.
I'm not going to switch this into a woman in the priesthood thing, but I do wonder if there's an underlying problem that may never get solved, in that children are brought up that the boys are important, and everyone knows what 12-year-old boys do. They stand up in front of the whole congregation and get voted on, and just, I mean, everyone knows what 12-year-old boys do. No one knows what 12-year-old girls do. And so on through 14 and 16. Is an underlying problem like that, where boys are important, girls aren't, going to be something that will make this never solved?
Well, I think that you're talking about a global problem, and we see its manifestations in many places. But I think that our ability to change the church from the top down is somewhat limited, but we actually have quite a lot of control over what happens in our homes and what happens in our families. And people who are aware of their parenting practices and aware of their marital practices and who make conscious decisions, I think, are in a position to become a light unto the Gentiles, even the Gentiles in the church. So thanks for bringing that up. Obviously, there are many manifestations that problem takes.
This question sort of follows along with that. I have really two questions. You've talked about an implicit model that we have in the church. What are the explicit models that young women are getting, the messages, and young men as well, about what a marriage should be? Are there really explicit messages? And is there a difference in the cultural messages that Utahns get versus the messages that are given to the church at large?
I think that one of the things that I looked at for this paper were the young women broadcasts, and the messages there are so explicit and so heavy-handed. President Hinckley said something like, Some young women have a hard time deciding on what they're going to major in college. But we want to encourage everybody to get out there and get an education and have it be something you enjoy, because someday you may need it. And I keep thinking, if young women are being told simultaneously that they should find something they love to do and prepare themselves to do it, but never do it unless it becomes necessary, is that possibly an explanation for why they're having trouble figuring out what it is they want to do? And I think that the explicit models are very coercive for teenage women. The last couple of young women broadcasts have emphasized to the point of caricature that their function is to serve their families. There's no recognition that teenage girls have some really important maturation tasks to do during those years. And in fact, some of those little vignettes that they showed were praising young women who took over because their mothers had chronic illnesses or because their mothers were dead. And I keep thinking, there's a real problem with this model to tell teenage girls that their value consists solely in the service they can provide to their families. Every family should be served by all of its members, and focusing on the teenage girls herds them into this category where they think that's the only thing they have a right to do. I read a sort of blood-curdling story about a 12-year-old in at Eagle Mountain in Utah Valley who was left in charge of five children. And one of the children ended up in the emergency room, and someone was quoted in the article saying that we think that we belong to a culture where we assume that girls are natural nurturers, that they come with built-in skills, and that, of course, a 12-year-old can handle five rambunctious kids. What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong is that something like this hasn't happened sooner. But I think that the assumption about this is what girls do, this is what they're good at, and the underlying text is this is the only thing they can do, this is the only thing they're good at. I think those messages are really out there and that they're really, really pernicious. You really got started on that one.
About a year ago, I sort of went to, I don't remember where I went, but I bought basically all the Young Women and the Young Men manuals and also the sort of equivalent for primary. I guess they have these Faith in God awards that they give now in primary, and they have little handbooks, for one for boys and one for girls. And I sort of went through the manuals and looked at what the differences really were, those explicit differences. What are the messages that girls, young women, are getting as opposed to boys? And there were pretty explicit differences. There were at least four lessons in the manual on issues related directly to motherhood and preparation for motherhood and preparation for marriage, and there really wasn't an equivalent to that in the boys' manual. Also, I've been teaching a Sunday school class recently, and I've been looking at the friend every month, and even in children that young, you just see the pictures in the friend, and it's always the girls that are doing the homemaking tasks and the boys who are sawing the wood with their father. And those, I think those are very subversive but very real influence. I mean, they have a real influence on children's socialization. And also I remember I grew up in California, but even there in young women's and young men's activities were very different. Young women learned to quilt and to sew and to bake cookies and do all those things. And I was always jealous because the boys got to go white water rafting and kayaking and just... So anyway, I don't know if that answers your question. But.
When I heard this gentleman comment that everyone knows what 12-year-old boys do, but no one knows what 12-year-old girls do, I thought, a lot of people know what 12-year-old girls do. They lock themselves in bathrooms with feminine hygiene products and try to figure out how to use them. And I think that's one issue there, that not only are young women not recognized in certain ways, but they're asked to be secretive and to be ashamed of these important maturation processes, Levina just mentioned, that they go through at age 12. So if we could figure out some way to, you know, take them maybe not out of the closet, but at least out of the bathroom, and have more of a sense of how this is going to be a part of their personhood and their humanhood, not just their womanhood, and how that relates to the entire world, and that they don't have to be ashamed of being women. It's not just learning to be, okay, I'm going to be this way and this way in this partnership, but simply in my own self. You know, I bleed, and that happens, and not being ashamed of menstrual cramps and all these things like this, that even the extent to which pregnancy is something you hide until, you know, it's very far along. So I don't know if either of you want to comment on that. So thank you.
So sorry, we must stop. I'm sure that if you'd like to speak with either of these two wonderful women afterwards, I would like to say that as a Mormon woman who grew up not Mormon in the state, I came into Mormonhood a little with different philosophies, but I will say that for the last 3.5 years, I have not cooked dinner once. My husband cooks dinner all the time. Brian Romrell, so you can all just, you know, next time you see him, thank him, bow down, you know. But he actually, as an attorney, and had was gone a lot during our early years of our marriage, but had a vocal cord paralyzed and came home. And when we decided we were going to split responsibilities, cleaning was not his thing, and doing the clothes he was worse at. And so we decided we were going to work on things that we were best at. So since he is much better at it than cooking, and it's been such a revelation, and the kids and the boys cook now, and it's, you know, you really can make your own model. So thank you so much for this wonderful, wonderful treat we've had today.
Because it takes too much effort.